And today we're in the second week of the KSFR Fun Drive, and I'd like to welcome Kirk Ellis. He's an American historian. He is the writer of the HBO John Adams series, and he is on the board of KSFR. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. Always a pleasure to be here.
So we are, before we start talking about free speech, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and all those very important things that are important to talk about, on or the day before the 4th of July, we wanted to let people know that it is the KSFR Fund Drive. This is the time where we assemble funds for the operations of the radio station, and we ask you to do so by calling 428-1393, 428-1393. And just before we went on the air, I was looking at my email, and I got an email from a local actor who said, "This community cannot afford to take KSFR Public Radio for granted, especially now. I hope the drive gains momentum and the goal is reached before Friday. Thank you so much for being there." And that is a typical letter we get from our listeners and real participants in this endeavor.
Well, I think it's very important that there be an independent voice in the media in a town of such incredible intellectual depth as Santa Fe. There needs to be a constant dialogue about many of the issues that you discuss on your show, that we'll be discussing today, and just about the American situation in general. And we've lost those kind of reasonable voices, and KSFR provides that.
Reasonable voices, I think, is a wonderful way of putting it, as opposed to polarized voices or strident voices or argumentative voices. Now, argumentation has a long and vibrant history in the United States of America.
Well, I mean, America was born out of revolution, and we've really never stopped arguing about what's the proper form of government. You and I have talked about that on previous shows, and I think that in leading up to this show and doing some research, I was struck once again by how incredibly argumentative the press was from the very beginning of our nation. And it's a great topic to discuss. People like to think that this is the most poisonous period in American politics, or that the media is just terrible. Well, they've been saying that for over 250 years.
428-1393 is the number, 428-1393. Call and make a contribution now. We are, I think, about $50,000 of the way to our $70,000 goal. And if we can make $20,000 in this hour, we'll be done. The chances of that are maybe not so great. But why don't we shoot for, what, $2,000,
$1,500? Let's do
$1,500. Let's shoot for $1,500 this hour. So let's get the phones ringing, 428-1393. And the toll-free number is 1-866-907-5737. That's 866-907-KSFR. And we will be giving that number over and over again because we want you to be able to have the time to write it down.
And yet somebody's got to start it, so I'll start it by pledging $100.
Oh, thank you.
Here we go.
Kirk Ellis. All right. We're $100 of our way to the $1,500 goal.
Always a soft touch when it comes to KSFR.
Well, thank you. So when you say that we were born of revolution and we've been arguing about the press and all this since the 18th century, what do you mean? What did the early press look like in the United States?
Well, in the beginning, there was an incredible plethora of newspapers. Pretty much anybody who had access to a printing press could print a paper that was really the 18th century equivalent of a blog. It was this particular editor's opinion about politics, the national situation, and it tended to be very, very personal. But in the United States, there were really two early papers of record, and they split along party lines. So you have to understand that at the beginning of the American Republic, you had the Federalist Party, which believed in the supremacy of the federal government over the rights of the states, that America needed to have a very strong centralized government to check it against the worst impulses of the various state legislatures. And you also had the Republican Party, which had many names. It was called the Republican Party, the Democratic Republican Party. It shifted over time. The names don't really correspond to Republican and Democrat as we understand them. But the Republican Party believed in a very loose federal government, and that most of the power would devolve to the individual states themselves. And so you had two papers. You had the Gazette of the United States, which was run by a man named John Fenno, who had fought in the Revolution. And it was a very strong Federalist paper. You had the Republican paper was called the American Aurora. I love that name. And it was actually run by a man named Benjamin Franklin Bache, who was, in fact, the grandson of Benjamin Franklin. And these two papers went at it tooth and nail, cats and dogs, week to week, day to day, about their favorite issues. And they could be unbelievably blistering in some of their commentary. And one of the favorite targets, for instance, I mean, it seems impossible for us to imagine, but one of the favorite targets of Benjamin Bache and the Aurora was George Washington, okay, who we now call the father of the country. But on the day that he left office and John Adams was sworn in, this is what the Aurora said. It said, when a retrospect is taken of the Washington administration of 8 years, it is the subject of the greatest astonishment that a single individual should have cankered the principles of republicanism in an enlightened people, just emerged from the gulf of despotism, and should have carried his designs against the public liberty so far as to put in jeopardy its very existence. Such, however, the facts, and with them staring us in the face, this day ought to be a jubilee in the United States. Now, that is an American newspaper celebrating the end of the Washington administration.
Amazing. What was the point he was trying to make? What was wrong with Washington?
It was believed by people on the Republican side of the aisle. And again, I just have to say, for people who may be tuning into this, when I use the word Republican, I'm using it in the 18th century sense. It was believed that Washington had been a not-so-benevolent dictator, that he had come out of retirement to assume the reins of the country and had then proceeded, in their mind, to institute a series of policies that were endangering to public liberty. Because Washington had a very firm hand on the plow when he was president of the United States. And there were many things. There were taxes on whiskey, for instance, that led to a rebellion in Pennsylvania that was rather brutally put down by Washington's troops under the command of Alexander Hamilton. And there were many things that went on. The Republican side wasn't happy with treaties that we made with England to stay out of war during Washington's second term. And it was during Washington's term that party politics really began in earnest in this country. Understand, the founders, in all of their wisdom, had not really foreseen the rise of party, certainly not as quickly as they did. They thought that Washington would unify the country, and by the time his second term came around, people were as polarized as they were today.
I heard somebody say, and I can't remember now who this was, that if you look at a person's childhood, it kind of talks, it basically speaks what their adulthood will be like. And the same with the founding of a nation. If you look at the early years of a nation, that sets the tone for the entire history or the entire development of that.
In order to achieve what we did during the Revolutionary period, we had to sort of silence debate on many subjects, which came back to haunt us. The first one was, of course, slavery. But beyond that, it was this idea that we were leaving a government that we considered tyrannical, that of the British Crown. And there were many people who believed that a lot of people didn't like the Constitution when it came out. Thomas Jefferson and John Adams were both in Europe as ambassadors when the Constitution was actually written. They didn't participate in the debate other than by letters to their various colleagues in Philadelphia. Jefferson disliked it from the moment that he saw it.
Why?
He believed that it gave too much power to the executive branch, and that the early drafts of it created what he called a Polish king, a president that could in fact be reelected ad infinitum. And it was really Washington who set the tone that there would be two terms for president and no more, which really was tradition until the Roosevelt administration, and four terms, which led to a constitutional amendment that
right.
actually said a president could only serve 8 years in office. So he did not see it as he saw it as a very dangerous document.
Was that the main reason, or were there other things?
Well, he saw, as so many did, that there was not a Bill of Rights. That there were no individual liberties guaranteed. And those were, of course, added very quickly so that the Constitution could be ratified, the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, and known as the Bill of Rights. And the one we're talking about today, I think it would be helpful for people to know what it actually says. It's the First Amendment to the Constitution, and it says, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, or of the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Those are all the things that are mentioned in the First Amendment to the Constitution, what we call the Free Speech Amendment.
We're talking to Kirk Ellis, and don't forget that it's the KSFR Fun Drive, 428-1393, 428-1393. We've got a couple of calls, but let's get the phones ringing and reach our goal of $1,500 for this hour as we talk about freedom of speech and freedom of the press. I was thinking about, I mean, there have been so many what people might think of as attacks on freedom of the press in different ways, but I remember when, for example, the Hurricane Katrina happened, and they were not letting journalists anywhere near the disaster scene. You had to be 300 yards away and things like that. And I was like, is this not constitutional? Are they actually violating the Bill of Rights?
I'll give you an example that I learned when we were filming John Adams in Colonial Williamsburg. We'd intended to do a bit more shooting there than we actually did. In the end, I think it was 4 days. But one of the things that we learned is that when you are in a public place such as Colonial Williamsburg, that belongs to everybody in America, you could not actually have the people you normally have to sort of block traffic or block people from walking into your shot, because that constituted a constitutional infringement of the right to assembly. So you could simply politely ask them to do things. And so, no, the press cannot be excluded from those kinds of events.
But it happens. And they
happens
do it at gunpoint.
Happens all the time. But again, it's not a particularly new tradition. Journalists, reporters, journalists, however you want to term them, have really been among the most hated people in America by the political class from the very beginning. John Adams actually called them terrorists because he was so angered by the personal attacks that were made on him, his wife, his administration. And even though the amendment clearly states that Congress shall make no law respecting, abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, less than a decade after these were ratified by the states, we were in a very perilous situation involving a potential war with France in 1798, and the press really stepped up attacks on the Adams administration and on the Federalist Party in general. And so the Federalists rammed through Congress what became the real black mark on the Adams administration, and that was the Sedition Act of 1798. And this is quite shocking. I hadn't looked at the text of the Sedition Act in a number of years. Here's how it read.
Okay.
It said, if any person shall write, print, utter, or publish, or shall knowingly assist or aid in writing, printing, uttering, or publishing any false and scandalous and malicious writing or writings against the government of the United States, or either House of the Congress of the United States, or the President of the United States, with the intent to defame the said government, or to bring them into contempt or disrepute, or to excite against them the hatred of the good people of the United States, then such person, being thereof convicted before any court of the United States having jurisdiction thereof, shall be punished by a fine not exceeding $2,000, that's $2,000 in money in 1798, and by imprisonment not exceeding 2 years. We literally made it a crime for a period of time for people to print anything that anybody in the government could say, that's offensive and that's hurtful, and you're going to jail.
And did people get convicted under that?
15 people were indicted, 11 went to trial, 10 were convicted, and 7 of those 10 who were convicted were journalists.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
And what kind of things did they say? Do we know?
Well, I mean, you know, I've quoted some examples from things like the Gazette of the United States and the Aurora that could be considered and construed as being contemptuous of the president or his administration. And it was those things that actually made it criminal.
428-1393. Kirk, the phones are quiet.
Oh, are they indeed?
Yes.
Okay. Well, that's not a good thing, because you see, silence is not an option. You either believe in an independent and free press or you don't. That's the debate that we have. You either believe in free speech for all or you don't believe in free speech. And if you believe in free speech, it's terribly incumbent on all of us to support institutions like KSFR, because it is through this radio station that you get a breadth of news and reporting that you don't get anywhere else.
428-1393 is the number, 428-1393, to make a contribution to KSFR. We want to reach a $1,500 goal for this hour. And I think, I mean, last year you and I sat on the plaza of Santa Fe and read the Declaration of Independence aloud and talked about it. And now we're looking at the Constitution and this whole issue of free speech. And there's so many ways of looking at free speech. I mean, one of the questions that we have in the media now is basically media consolidation.
Yes.
Who owns it? Are they making money off of it? Are they telling the truth? Is there any, I mean, there's nothing in the Constitution that says you have to tell the truth. And there's nothing in any law that says you have to tell the truth.
Well, actually, it's interesting you mention that, because one of the reasons that more people weren't prosecuted under the Sedition Act in 1798 is that truth could be used as a defense. And many times the Federalist Party actually didn't want to bring those cases to trial because the reporters, the journalists, could actually prove the allegations they were making.
Very interesting.
Okay? So that was interesting. I mean, if you're going to write a sedition act, okay, don't make truth a defense. You need to be much more Machiavellian than that. And it's interesting you bring up this whole nature of media combination, because the press of the late 18th century in America really more closely resembles today's blogosphere, independent blogosphere, than it does newspapers, television, radio, you know, and the mass media.
Right.
Which is what made it so dangerous for the people in power, and why they really treated journalists like dirt, and why they tried to actually prosecute them for saying things that they were simply unhappy with. I don't think that's actually changed. You know, you go to Watergate, you go to what happened with you know, Joe Wilson and Valerie Plame. And, I mean, all of this comes down to the fact that somebody says something that goes against, you know, the grain of what a given administration wants to propagate to the American people. And that's why the press needs to retain a certain amount of independence.
Now, there was some wisdom, obviously, in the First Amendment, and I think it's very important to talk about the necessity of an educated populace via the media for democracy. People don't know what they're talking about. People don't know what's going on. You can't really have a functional democracy.
Well, the founders predicated everything in all of our founding documents on the idea of an educated populace. Now, bear in mind that populace was considered by them to be exclusively white, exclusively male, exclusively well-heeled. But it was also the fact that people thought about politics, they lived politics, they ate politics, they drank politics. Taverns were dangerous places to be for the ruling class in the pre-revolutionary era, because that was the hotbed of sedition and revolutionary thought, as it was in France, and as it really remains. We're sitting here in a cafe talking about the freedom of the press for an independent radio station, so I love that whole continuity. Now, with this consolidation, what you have, and I think both sides are guilty of it to a certain degree, but clearly people are on the right of center really use the airwaves more cunningly to simply broadcast a message. You can listen to talk radio, you know, on Clear Channel from 9 to 12, from 12 to 3, from 3 to 6, and even though the voice of the host is different, the messages are all the same. The same thing is being said over and over and over again. And it was a really good propagandist by the name of Joseph Goebbels, who worked for a very interesting employer during World War II, who said that, you know, if you tell people the same thing over and over again, they'll start to believe it. And right. That's really kind of what you're seeing now.
Right.
You know? And that goes totally against the grain of the kind of dialogue the founders intended.
And the kind of dialogue that the founders intended are the kind of things that we try to do on KSFR, to actually have thoughtful conversations about things. I mean, there are so many issues that are not what you might call two-sided. They're multi-sided. There are so many ways of looking at things. And the mindset with which you approach something. I've been thinking lately and just reading stuff about, you know, the indigenous mindset versus the scientific mindset. You know, you look at nature in very different ways. Neither one of them you have to can say is right or wrong, and it doesn't make for a two-sided argument. It makes for kind of opening and expanding your own mind to different people's perspectives, which I think is crucially important.
No, I think that is the key thing, and I do tend to pontificate quite a bit about the complexity of history, because that's how I make my living in the dramatization of actual events, both from the near and distant past. pardon me, and I, the more you delve into a particular issue, the more complex it becomes, and you learn that there is no one way and certainly no right way of telling that story. There is a myriad of narrative in even the simplest kind of tale. And our perceptions, and you and I talked about this a bit when we were talking about Iranian film, when you look at how people construct stories, you learn an awful lot about how their mind and how their mind works and how their view of the world is quite different. You know, we Americans are very linear-minded. You know, this happens, this happens, this happens, this happens, which leads to that sort of relentless three-act structure in all of our narratives. And it lacks a certain complexity that you find in narratives from, say, Asia, which tend to be very circular and open-ended. And it's so crucial at times like this, whether it's a fun drive or whether we're talking about an election year, that we open up our ears to the stories that people are telling us and understand that they're not against us. They're not, it's not me or you, us against the world. We're all part of this great universe, and we need to start listening to each other and cooperating more, because that's the only way any of us are going to survive.
428-1393 is the number. And again, the phones are rather quiet. Not sure what's going on. We've had a great week so far, and maybe I'm guessing that people are just fascinated by the issues and thinking about them and haven't actually gotten up and
well, I can try to say something incredibly offensive and they'll call you up just to get me off the air. You can try that as a particular attack.
No, that's what the media, that's what the commercial media do that we don't like. Like, what do you want to be, a shock jock?
No, but I mean, folks, I mean, if you're listening to this program and you agree or disagree with anything that we're saying, it's really important for you to vote, you know, with your pledge, because it's through your pledge that the station is able to continue to bring you really diverse programming. And we just sort of are in the midst of a conversation about the importance of diversity in the media culture.
428-1393. The phones are starting to ring. Wonderful. Keep the momentum. 428-1393. Now, the diversity of media, I think there's something tricky about that, because right now, you and I and everybody else in the nation, most of whom have access to computers, really virtually everybody at this point has access to a computer if they're near enough to a public library, and many have them at home, and many have multiple computers at home. We have access to virtually everything in the universe, and yet what happens is people tend to look at the things that they like and already agree with, and I imagine the same thing was going on 200 years ago.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And I mean, that tradition is carried on in the European press, for instance. If you live in England and you're a member of the Conservative Party, you will read The Times. If you're a member of the Liberal Party, you will read The Guardian. If you're somewhere in between, you'll read The Independent, or you'll read all three of them to try to get a balanced viewpoint. That's true in France, it's true in Spain, it's true in Germany. It's only in America that we have this idea that what we're getting is, quote, objective journalism, when in fact it's not. But I think that you've hit on a key point, which is that even though there is access to the internet, and that digital divide is shrinking, it's not completely gone, but it is shrinking a bit, people tend to read things that they know they will agree with. And then not to actually open up a file with a competing point of view. And that, again, is in the very best, and I'm putting best in air quotes, the very best tradition of American journalism from the founding era. I mean, I'll give you an example. In the election of 1800, you know, I love hearing every 4 years, oh, this is the worst election I've ever seen. People are so nasty. I was just here the other day hearing somebody talk about they just can't listen to any of this stuff anymore. It's so terrible.
Well, I feel that way.
Well, okay, The election of 1800, in my mind, which was the election that made John Adams a one-term president, put Thomas Jefferson in office, was and remains the dirtiest example of mudslinging in the press that you will ever encounter. And here's a real example.
Now, who was running in 1800?
It was John Adams against Thomas Jefferson.
Okay.
And remember, at this point, I think this was actually a great system. The candidates themselves didn't run. It was considered beneath them to campaign for office. So there were minions throughout the country, largely in the press, who did their work for them. And so the Gazette of the United States, which we were talking about at the beginning of this conversation, which was the Federalist paper, wrote this. said Jefferson has embarked upon the tempestuous ocean of public life without a reference to the integrity of the means by which their ends are to be accomplished. He has been aiming at the malignancy of a free people. He is an enemy to American manufacturers, absolutely and forever, and furthermore, he considers all the merchants of the United States so many curses instead of blessings. Now, you change that period verbiage, and it could sound like something you're hearing on an attack ad today.
Yeah, somebody's anti-business.
Exactly. So, the same paper, a few weeks before the election, then writes this, and they put everything in capital letters. The grand question stated, at the present solemn and momentous epoch, the only question to be asked by every American laying his hand on his heart is, shall I continue in allegiance to God and a religious president, or impiously declare for Jefferson and no God? So here we are, okay, the first peaceful transference of power in the history of Western civilization, you know, between, you know, Adams and Jefferson, when one party, you know, gives way to another party. And it comes down to this. It comes down to this idea, who is the more religious?
Right.
I believe we are seeing that same debate played out today.
It's extraordinary, really, that we repeat history so much, and especially since we have in our Bill of Rights this whole separation, essentially separation of church and state.
Right, right. Well, now, the idea that the word separation of church and state doesn't actually appear in the Constitution.
Right.
It comes from a letter that Jefferson wrote. But nevertheless, I think in reading this amendment again, which very clearly states, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, the founders were very clear in their intentions. And you've had people on the show like Mikey Weinstein, who can speak much more eloquently than I can on that separation, because Mikey's dealing with it every day in the armed forces.
Yeah, he is the one who's dealing with the prevalence of evangelical Christianity in the armed forces and how basically soldiers are forced to pray or to practice not only a religion, but specific religion.
This idea that America's a Christian nation, and I mean, that's the subject for a whole other show.
Yeah.
Again, the idea that the Constitution specifically tells us how to believe, how to behave in our personal lives, it's not borne out by the actual text itself. You and I were talking before the show began, and the founders were very, very smart, and they made it extremely difficult to amend the Constitution. And at no time did they ever intend that the amendments to the Constitution would regulate personal behavior. All the amendments, and there are, I've got a little copy of it here in front of me, there are, I believe, 26 amendments to the Constitution. 26 amendments, okay? Not that many. Almost all of them deal with increased enfranchisement. Blacks have the right to vote. Women have the right to vote. People under the age of 21 have the right to vote. It's all about that. Or it's all about regulating Congress's power to tax. Let's have an income tax. That's not in the Constitution. It needs an amendment. So I am less fearful than some when I start to hear people bloviating on the floor of the House or Senate about how we are going to have a defense of marriage amendment. It's never going to happen.
Bloviating.
Bloviating. Bloviating.
No,
yes.
Bloviating on KSFR.
Well, it'll always be interesting bloviating on KSFR.
428-1393. And again, the phones are a little slow, and maybe people are getting ready for the 4th of July. And people's minds are on the celebration of our nation's independence. But as you think about our nation's independence, think about what it means and what free speech means to you and what good information means to you. 428-1393. Call up and make a contribution of any size. If you make a contribution of $10, that's great, or $20, or as we've talked about before, $10 or $20 or $15, whatever, per month, you sign up for that monthly giving, it makes a huge difference to the station. It also makes a huge difference to our listeners, because then they don't have to worry about, hey, did I give last time, or how much did I give? You know, you just do whatever is within your means and make that call. And also, you know, if you support the Radio Cafe, if this is a show you listen to every day and you want to support it and you want me to stay here for years to come, which is my plan.
I certainly hope so.
But we can only do that if you make a contribution. So it's listener-supported public radio. Please call us right now, 428-1393. We're not even close to halfway to our $1,500 goal.
That's not good. So let's go back to some important words in the late 18th century in America, and those were duty and sacrifice. And that idea of public service, that was not something that people had to be goaded into doing, you know, the way we're sort of hectoring people to give money to the station. It was something that people did because it was the right thing to do. And as we really approach, you know, our nation's independence, which technically, by the way, I have to, you know, give a shout out here to John Adams, it was yesterday. It was actually July 2nd on which the Continental Congress declared us independent. It took 2 days to go through and make 88 changes in Jefferson's Declaration for it to actually be published to the people. So we have two Independence Days. And it seems this week, because everybody's celebrating by taking a week off,
right,
on Independence Day, that we are getting both of those days celebrated. And I think that we sometimes forget the nature of the holiday. I mean, this was a fundamental change in a nation, a government, and a people. And it was a terrible, terrible leap into the dark, the outcome of which was by no means certain. And we celebrate it with fireworks, although we shouldn't be doing it in New Mexico this year.
No.
But we should also, John Adams said it should be a moment for solemn reckoning, where we should really think about how far we've come every year to honoring, you know, that sacrifice. And this is a perfect occasion. If you really believe in the idea of American independence, there's no better way to express it than by making sure that there will always be a place for independent voices to debate and discuss in a way that isn't not only talking heads, but screaming heads.
428-1393, 428-1393. I think the most important thing that you can do in media is not tell people what to think, but help them to think. Help them to think for themselves.
Well, I'm still trying to understand at what point in our history we became a nation that wanted to be told what to think. And there are these periods that always seem to be around religious revivals, oddly enough, where the idea that, you know, we can reason for ourselves and we can come to our own conclusion become anathema. And it's better just to have somebody telling us what to believe.
It's interesting. Obedience versus independence.
Correct. I suppose that would be a modern expression of the debate that Adams and Jefferson always had about government, you know. But I don't think it was ever in anybody's head that people would mindlessly obey, and that there would always be a sense that discussion, education, and enlightenment would win out. Unfortunately, we're now in a society where none of those attributes seem to prevail anymore.
No, and as we talked about on this program yesterday, there has been a concerted effort to weaken American public education, which is much weaker than it was when I was in school many decades ago now.
Right.
And if you have a school system which is basically teaching people to take tests and having a kind of just say no to drugs curriculum, and that's pretty much it.
Right.
You're not going to teach them how to think and how to make decisions. And not only is it a problem for democracy, frankly, it's a problem for the workforce.
Correct. I mean, because if people are merely being taught to answer a set of multiple choice questions and being taught only a certain number of disciplines, you know, science and math versus history, you know, English, literature, the arts, and all of that, the people who lack that well-rounded education are simply not fit to enter the workforce. And that leads to all kinds of problems. I mean, you see where that leads us in Egypt, you know, and various other countries where you have a shockingly unemployed force of youth with a lot of time on their hands.
That's right.
And I despair. I've told this joke many times, you know, that my wife calls me a misanthrope, and I keep reminding her that a misanthrope is merely an optimist who's been disappointed too many times by too many people. But that's the society we live in today. There's not a premium put on education, on independent thought, and on a really well-versed background.
428-1393 is the number if you believe in free thought, if you believe in thinking about the issues, if you believe in that whole beautiful diversity of issues which KSFR brings you. Please give us a call and support the station, 428-1393, and get those phones ringing crazily, which we've had the whole slew of good days in a row, and let's just keep that going. I have to say, you know, another thing that's happened is the whole anti-government idea, which I think is so paradoxical, because people claim to love the Constitution, maybe they've read it, maybe they haven't, and yet at the same time be against government and talk about all the inefficiencies of government. Yesterday, I had to go to the county clerk's office and get a document. And so I put a half an hour's worth of coins in the meters, thinking, well, maybe I'll have to run out and put some more in. I was in and out of that office in 3 minutes. An efficient, handsome, friendly clerk pulled this document in 1 minute and gave it to me for $1. And I thought, my government is working just fine. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. And I mean, the government is there, regardless of whether you think it's too powerful or the power should reside in the states or in Washington, D.C., the government provides us with some very, very important services. And I actually find the idea that government is the problem inconsistent among many of the people who hold that belief, because on the one hand, they think government shouldn't do anything except when they have beliefs about personal behavior. Then they want government to step in and do something, but that's not the government that the founders set up in the Constitution. It has nothing, as we talked about earlier, it has nothing to do with how one behaves behind closed doors. It's all about the public nature of our role as citizens.
So the government that was set up in 1776, 1789, that period of our history really didn't care whether you were gay or not?
Oh, now we get into this whole issue about what the founders anticipated, what they thought about the individual. And I know Adams better than I know most of the other founders. And one of the things that Adams did in between his two terms in Paris was he came back to Massachusetts to write the Massachusetts Constitution, the oldest state constitution, in America, and in many ways, the basis for our Constitution as a nation. And he was asked toward the end of his life what some of his proudest achievements were. And among them, he listed the fact that he was the author of the Religious Freedom Clause in the Massachusetts Constitution. And in writing that, he corresponded with a Jewish friend in Boston. And you can imagine how really prescient that was, for somebody of Adams's Puritan background, to have this wonderfully Catholic sense, Catholic with a small c, of the nature of society. So whether or not were there gay men in the Revolution, there were, I think, gay men in the Continental Congress, but that wasn't the issue. The issue wasn't about who you were and what you did. It was about what you believed and how you were willing to sacrifice for your country.
Right.
And we've lost that whole idea.
So the idea that if you, behind closed doors, did whatever you wanted to do, basically the ethos of our country was...
That was nobody's
we
business.
We overlooked that. It was nobody's
business. That was nobody's
business.
Nobody's business.
That very was, interesting.
Yeah, I mean, that freedom is a really tricky word. And I do really kind of see it in this, Kierkegaardian absolute. It's this idea that you either believe in it or you don't.
Well, what does it mean?
Well, freedom of speech. Freedom of speech, in my mind, means that that the Anti-Defamation League has the same right, to a rally as, say, the Ku Klux Klan, as long as, and it's in the Constitution, it is a peaceful assembly.
Right.
And you say, well, I hate those people. They shouldn't have a right to say anything. Well, of course they have a right to say things. Now, they can go beyond the line, and it can become hate speech, and then we go into the Supreme Court definition of what hate speech, entails, and that's a constantly evolving set of decisions, as is everything in the current Supreme Court, it seems. But you believe in freedom or you don't.
428-1393. Cast your vote for freedom right now on KSFR. We have reached just about $500, so we're doing a little better, but we got to get those phones ringing off the hook, and we got to get some thank yous, too. Do we have some thank yous, Marilyn?
We have tons of thank yous.
Oh, yay.
Yes, people have been calling in and just very appreciative of what both of you are talking about.
Excellent.
So here are the thanks.
All right.
Sally Denton.
Thank you.
Eric Witt.
Yay.
Hey.
Terry Koss.
Thank you.
Gerald Schreed.
All right.
And Dominique Mazzod. And Richard Miller.
Thank you.
Carolyn Hinsky from Taos.
Yay.
Suzanne Lederer.
Wonderful.
Oh, great.
I said Terry Koss earlier.
Yeah.
I've got names doubled up here. James McGrath Morris.
Oh, wonderful.
Tom Leach from Palace Press, who just felt he had to contribute during
this. Yes, Freedom of the Palace Press.
Yes.
Thank you.
Michael Smith is donating during your show because he loves the diversity that you present.
Thank you.
And Howard Gross wants to donate during your show also for that reason. Lots of wonderful comments about what you two are talking about. Keep up the good work.
Oh, thank you. Well, 428-1393, keep up the good calls.
So here's something for all your listeners to imagine. Imagine that you and I just stop talking now for the remaining 10 or so minutes of the show, and there was just silence. That's what would happen if people stopped calling.
Exactly.
And that's what we cannot afford, because in the silence, there is tyranny.
Imagine something even worse than the silence. Let's imitate what it could be. Obama's a socialist.
Oh, yeah, and Romney's a religious fanatic who believes that big business should have all the money in the country.
Yeah, and you're stupid because you think that.
Well, and you're stupid because you think that.
Well, but you're stupider because I have more evidence. Well, where is it?
Well,
wait.
Now it turns into a Pee Wee Herman routine. It's like, I know what you are, but what am I? I know what you are, but what am I?
Oh,
and I'll tell you something, Mary Charlotte. I actually, in the privacy of my own car, listen to a lot of conservative talk radio, because I think it's really, really important for people who may be on the other side of the fence to understand what the message is from day to day that's going on. And I've gotten to be pretty good at actually anticipating it. For instance, when the Roberts Court, stunning everybody in the media, by the way, and people on both sides of the political aisle, doomed Obamacare to the dustbin of history.
Right. I
mean, and CNN actually got it wrong. You know, they actually misread the decision, right? So I knew the moment it got approved that the next day I would be listening to Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, and some of the others, Mark Levin, and they would be saying, you see, we were right from the very beginning. Obamacare is a tax. It had nothing to do with the Commerce Clause, because it was the only thing they could get, onto. So it's like tax, 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 tax. So you probably heard the word tax 12 times a minute. So now you'll have everybody saying, well, see, it's a tax. I don't want to pay that tax.
Yeah.
You know, when it's only actually a $90 penalty, I believe, on your income tax if you decide not to actually buy into the program. So you have to be willing to listen to what may be to you personally unpleasant alternative voices, just so you can understand what's happening in that screamosphere,
right?
And be able to sort of come up with rational arguments. Now, will you be able to press your rational argument to somebody? That may be difficult, but at least you're understanding what it is.
428-1393. Please support this station, and we will never be the screamosphere.
Yeah. You're not a very good screamer. I can do it.
No, screaming is not really my great strength. But it's interesting. I was pretty sure that the decision was going to go the way it was, because the person who I spoke to most about it is a friend of mine who's an attorney, and he actually listened to the questions that they were asking during the arguments. And having listened to all the questions, this person fanatically listens to Supreme Court deliberations, said Obamacare is not going to be, it's not called repealed, what's it called? Overturned.
Overturned, yeah.
Because I listened to what each one was saying, and this is the way it's going to go, and that's exactly the way it went. So, well, I wasn't surprised.
And your friend is a very good reporter in that sense, either amateur or professional, because most of the media only listened to the hostile questions that were coming from people like Kennedy and Scalia and Alito.
Right.
When you go back to those transcripts and you listen to what Roberts was actually saying, and remembering what Roberts said when he was being confirmed, that he was going to try to judge most cases on a very narrow basis, this is one time where he actually lived up to that promise. And he found a way to, I think, a very Solomonic way to keep that initiative alive.
428-1393. Let's hope to get a flurry of calls in the last 8 minutes of this program, so that we can reach our goal, and so that we can really reach our $70,000 goal for this fund drive, which I guess is probably going to be going on through Friday. But we've got some great shows for you over the next few days.
And $70,000 is not an unreasonable goal. You know, we were talking earlier about the fact that in many cities, $70,000 is what they raise in a pledge drive in an hour.
That's right. Yeah, you know? Huge cities where they've got thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands of listeners.
But I mean, in Santa Fe, a city that prides itself on its very independent spirit, Santa Fe, we can all do better. And I'll start that by pledging another $100.
Oh, Kirk Ellis. What a guy. 428-1393. And if you're asking yourself, should I give now, ask, what would Kirk Ellis do?
I don't think that's ever going to be a really popular bumper sticker. Actually, I really don't. But thank you for suggesting it.
428-1393. So we've talked about reason. We've talked about religion. We've talked about education. We've talked about media consolidation. And the thing that I get out of talking to you, Kirk Ellis, about the various things we talk about is that whatever issue we look at, or whatever issue we look at in our current politics, it has precedence in American history.
That's correct.
And often the bloviation from the previous time is, believe it or not, even crazier and more vitriolic than it is now.
Oh, absolutely. No, absolutely. I mean, the press in the founding period was among the most vituperative, vitriolic. They were always in attack mode. There was never a mode in which they were willing to listen to the other side. Papers literally writing, you know, editorials about editorials in other papers. The editors going at each other. And often the people writing those editorials were writing under names like Cato or Catullus. They all had these great sort of Roman pen names. And they were people like Hamilton and Madison. And remember that what became the Federalist Papers, these articles that were used to promote the cause of the Constitution, were written as newspaper editorials under pen names.
Right.
And so, yes, the press could be used. That was an example of politicians in government using the press to spread their particular message. In this case, it was a message saying to the people, we have to be united. The Articles of Confederation aren't working. We need a much stronger government, and here are the reasons for it. And people were digesting those, and they were reading them, and they were rereading them, and they were talking about them, and ultimately the Constitution was ratified.
428-1393. We need $251.
Oh, we can do
by
that.
The end of this hour, which is another 5 minutes. So let's go for it. Let's go for it real quick. 428-1393. I think one of the things that you're saying is there's a great deal of talking and not all that much listening. And so cultivating the art of listening in oneself, I think, is an important thing. And it's tricky in an education system where you're always having to write papers and make statements and you know, keep your argument in the debate strong. And all of those things are wonderful things. But sometimes when I look at President Obama, who grew up in different parts of the world, not just in the United States, I see a human being who has a very well-developed capacity to listen and to hear other people's arguments and to really take them in and digest them and integrate them. And that may or may not be a political asset in a country like this.
Well, I mean, I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right, you know, in your assessment of President Obama. We now live in a place where apparently listening to people and reaching across the aisle, which is what the whole institution of government as we set it up is about, is considered to be a negative. The moment you say that person has a point, somebody from either side is on your case saying, you know, there can be no compromise with these people.
Right.
It's us or them. And there has been, again, always that apocalyptic nature in political discussion in America. We talked earlier about the 1800 election between Adams and Jefferson. Both sides on that debate honestly believed if their candidate didn't win, the America that they had all fought for would literally cease to exist. And
right.
Of course it didn't. But
right.
but it was implanted in our national DNA that there would be that kind of darkness in the discussion.
428-1393, 428-1393. And so in the election of 1800,
mm-hmm.
who won?
The election of 1800 was won barely by Thomas Jefferson. It went to the House of Representatives, and there were over 30 ballots taken before he was finally proclaimed President of the United States.
Amazing. And how did... Why do you think he won, or was it just sort of too close to call? Either it could have gone either way.
Well, my own take on that actually was expressed in the miniseries. John Adams did everything he could as President of the United States to keep us out of a war with France. France and Britain were perpetually at war in the first 25 to 30 years of this country's existence. And there were people who believed we should be fighting with Britain or fighting with France. And Adams believed that we shouldn't be fighting with anybody. We weren't prepared for it. We weren't prepared for a war. He was later proved right when we got involved in the War of 1812 and the British came and burned the White House. There was tremendous public sentiment. Tremendous public sentiment for us to be at war with France. Huge rallies. Had he declared war on France, he would have been handily reelected. In fact, he tried to get a treaty which arrived shortly before he was deposed as president in the election of 1800. I think that was part of it. And the Jeffersonian camp actually used a lot of that they called him a warmonger, even though he was trying to do things through diplomatic channels. And that hurt him in the election. And I found it at the time we were making the film in 2008, which was during the Democratic primary, that the idea of a president who was voted out of office because he kept us out of war was very topical then with the wars we were fighting, and it still remains topical. It's a very brave thing to do.
4281393. And the idea that war is a good thing and that we like war, maybe does that come from our being a revolutionary country?
Well, I mean, when you study the history of the Revolution and the founding generation or two of this country, you find that it's as much a story of diplomacy, if not a larger story of diplomacy, than it is a story of actually fighting battles. Because all of the great victories that we made were really done sort of after the fact.
Very interesting. Yeah. It's just about time to go, so I want to thank everybody who has called in. Do we have a few more thank yous, Mary Lynn?
We do. Nancy Moline.
Yay.
Janice Quinn for wonderful things you do for nonprofits.
Thanks.
And, of course, Cy Husbeck. And Marie Mobley.
Yay.
Beverly Singer. Yay. Gary Polkowitz.
Okay.
He gives you tough things to think about throughout the day. Anne Wrinkle, who took up your plea to get you over the goal.
Yay!
And there are some more, some anonymous, and there's more phones coming in. So thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you so much.
Lois Fecto, too, who loves what you do for the arts.
Wonderful. Well, we've got just less than a minute left, and I want to thank you, Kirk Ellis, for not only being with us today, but for your thoughtful work of bringing these questions to the people through the mass media.
Correct. I like to stir it up.
Yeah, and not just through, I mean, academia is a wonderful thing, and that's where we get our history, and that's where we get the books you're working.
Some anonymous, and there's more phones coming in, so thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you so much.
Lois Fecto, too, who loves what you do for the arts.
Wonderful. Well, we've got just less than a minute left, and I want to thank you, Kirk Ellis, for not only being with us today, but for your thoughtful work of bringing these questions to the people through the mass media.
Correct. I like to stir it up.
Yeah, and not just through, I mean, academia is a wonderful thing, and that's where we get our history, and that's where we get the books you're working with, but you bring it out, as we try to do here at KSFR, to people who aren't academics.
Well, and I think you and I both come from the same school. We really believe in the responsibility of the media, and I've learned over time that if people know something about a historical subject, chances are they've learned about it on TV. And so that makes my job even harder, because there has to be a responsibility in what you do to tell the story dramatically, but also accurately.
Kirk Ellis, thank you so much for being with us. And everybody, thank you so much for calling 4281393 Radio Cafe. Adios.